Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung.
Hello.
We're remote here at the, what's the name of the studio?
BlackRock EPS.
Okay. And we just finished a little session this morning, right? It's Sunday.
Yeah.
I have some, like, sort of wide-ranging subject areas I want to talk to you about today, okay?
Okay.
And I want to hear, because you have such a varied background, your experience is pretty vast at this point, actually. So I want to talk about that, okay? First thing, as a recording engineer, how the hell can you be so patient all the time? Like, it's a stressful job, right? You're at the helm. Technical things are always going to happen. You're always going to be problem solving. All sorts of different personalities, right, that you're working with. How do you do it?
Well, I guess when I first started in this business, I came back from school and was working with Mike Sack, who owned Trackmaster at the time. And he said something that, you know, when I first heard it, I thought it was kind of funny, but then I thought about it and, you know, still think about it to this day, where he said, make sure you pay attention to everything you learned in your psychology elective. So obviously when you graduate college, you have to take a humanities course, and psychology is one of them. So I think, to answer your question there, is I think about what we did talk about in those psychology, that psychology class, because it wasn't classes, it was just like intro to psych or whatever, mm-hmm. and just how to pay attention to people, you know, how to react to their reactions of what's going on. I think the big thing for me that I try to do is to not have the band see the equipment that's in the studio. So when they go in and they take a tour of the studio, let's say it's like, yeah, they want to be, you want to wow them with like the amount of space that's in there or how clean it is and the microphone collection and preamps that might be there, or maybe the type of console you have. But when they're actually in there spending money and recording, you don't really want them to see any of that. Like, they don't want to, you know, that, because that's going to take away from the project essentially.
You're right? Saying if you tell them what you're doing all the time, or...
Well, if you tell them what you're doing, or just as you said earlier, you know, tech issues are going to come up where maybe something's mm-hmm. not working the way it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And just being able to stay, you know, calm, cool, and collected, and...
Do you feel that calm inside? Like, when something is, like, crashing, aren't you like, oh, shit, but...
it depends on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, today you and I had a session and it wasn't playing back, and I just had to quickly troubleshoot why, you know, the session wasn't playing. I knew that it wasn't a major problem,
mm-hmm.
but I just kind of had to keep moving forward and figuring out what the issue was, and it was a simple problem. So at that point, no, I wasn't stressed.
Okay.
However, I remember I did a live broadcast with Bare Naked Ladies back in the 90s. And, you know, the Bare Naked Ladies are playing live in the studio. There's a studio audience of maybe 50 or 60 people there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I'm getting nervous already.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're sending it over an ISDN line where you can send audio to different studios in the country, or you can send it to radio stations. So this was being sent directly over to 103.3, and they were doing a live broadcast from the studio with the Bare Naked Ladies, and then all of a sudden, you know, the radio station lost the feed that I was sending to them. So that was a little stressful, you know, because I was hearing it.
How long was it gone for?
It was only gone for maybe 5 minutes, because I had to quickly figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
The short story is that there was an engineer that was downstairs. He got some bad news and had to leave real quick, and he did what he normally does when he leaves the studio at night, and he just shut everything downstairs.
Sort of like Chevy Chase doing his Christmas lights and Christmas vacation,
correct.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he just kind of shut everything down, which was the ISDN line that I was using. So I had to quickly think, where do I start to see where the problem is?
Right.
You know, do I start in the studio where the band is playing and there's 60 guests? Probably not, because people are going to wonder, like, what is going on? Like, why is this guy running around with a red face, sweating, pulling these cables or whatever, right? So I knew I was hearing it through my speakers, and I just decided, let me start at the other end, which was going to the radio station. Maybe that's the issue. Mm-hmm. And I went downstairs and was off. I turned it back on, and the feed was
okay,
back
yeah.
there.
Thinking on your feet, problem solving. Talk to me about dealing with different personalities, right? Because I've worked with a lot of different people, too, and I know some people are hands-off, some people are hands-on, some people are, like, getting drunk or smoking or whatever, mm-hmm. and, like, some people have an attitude. Like, I'm sure you've seen all of it. Like, what have you learned how to deal with all sorts of different personalities and situations?
Well, I think it's always better to not react quickly, you know, kind of see, like, what's going on. So, for example, if you have someone who's just kind of like a hard person to talk to for whatever reason, maybe they're just assertive, which is fine. Why are they being assertive? Well, probably because they care about the recording project that they're mm-hmm. they're doing. And you just have to take that stuff as a grain of salt, I think. You know, I mean, it's real easy, I guess, to react or become offended or try to push back. But ultimately, you're trying to make their project the way that they want, and they know how they want their project to sound. And maybe you're misreading them, right? Like, maybe mm-hmm. they don't mean for it to come off as pompous or mm-hmm. hard to get along with or whatever. But ultimately, you're both there for the same thing. They want to have their project recorded and sounding the way that they want it to, and you're there to help them do that.
Uh-huh.
But there are times that it's hard, you know, where you kind of feel like you've gotten beaten up a little bit verbally for some reason. And then there's other times, obviously, where it's great. You know, everyone gets along. It's mm-hmm. like a huge, you know, love fest, mm-hmm. I guess, right? And then as far as, like, the other things that may happen, like if there's people imbibing too much or whatever in the studio, you got to kind of police that a little bit as best you can, you know.
Not to mention the long days. Like you have hour, like, sessions, I'm sure, where there's 10 hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your ears get tired, and you get fatigued, right? And how do you deal with that? How do you avoid that happening?
I think you just have to, again, police yourself. You got to, you know, not always listen to everything at full volume. Like, you know, bring the monitoring down when you can. Take breaks when you can. You know, don't work during your lunch if you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, and I had my own studio, it was a crazy schedule because I was working at Channel 2, the NBC affiliate here in town. And I would work there part-time, so I would go there at 4
a.m. As what? What was your job there?
I was a production assistant, so mm-hmm. I did cameras for the news or rolled the teleprompter, floor directing, things like that. But I just worked there for the morning show, so I'd have to be there at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. And then I would stay until 9, so I worked 5 hours. So I would do 4 to 9 a.m. Then I would go to the studio that I, you know, was trying to run. And from 9 till 12, let's say, on a normal day would be when I would call back clients to, you know, try to get bills paid or paying bills that I had to pay, like electric bills, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
or making calls out to try to generate more business. And then the bands would come in, and normally we would do like a 12 to midnight type of a shift. If it was a day lockout.
Yeah, 12-hour shift.
Right.
So you're talking 4 a.m. to 12 a.m.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. So it was a crazy, and that's one thing too, where, you know, as a musician and everything that you're involved with, that this type of career, these types of careers could be in theater, music, whatever it is. They're more of like the lifestyle as opposed to you go to work at 8, you work till 4, maybe you have a half hour break.
I hear you. Yeah, you know? I hear you. So that you're right. That does become your life, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of owning your own studio, Did that probably added with it a lot of rewards, but also a lot of pressure as well. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, it was rewarding because I was building something. You know, I was starting to create a scene inside that studio, mm-hmm. almost like what Trackmaster had, because every studio kind of has their own feel, right? So it's like Select Sound here in town has its own feel and type of clients that normally go there. GCR, yeah. Same thing. BlackRock, sure. EPS, same thing. And I was doing more of like the indie stuff and more of the garage band or indie punk, mm-hmm. Americana type music, like, you know, Steam Donkeys or Girl Pope, Doom Buggy, Irving Claws, you know, things like that, which was rewarding because you could see that you're starting to build the scene amongst that genre, mm-hmm. of musicians, but you still had that monthly expense you had to make, you know, which was at that time.
Yeah.
I had to have about 10 days of studio time booked a month. So the overhead was about, you know, $5,000 a month when you took in business loan payments.
Yep.
You know,
overhead,
just, right? Overhead,
equipment maintenance, and yeah,
right, equipment maintenance, insurance, paying your sales tax, paying the accountant to help you do your taxes quarterly, lawyer fees for the articles of incorporation. It's like there's so much stuff you don't necessarily think about until you have to think about it. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we have to buy coffee grounds if we want our clients to be able to have coffee, mm-hmm. or you want the phone to ring, so you got to pay your phone bill. You got to pay your electric bill, your water bill. You mm-hmm. have rent, all that stuff.
Did any of that diminish your love and appreciation of the music? Did that take a toll?
I think after time it does, because you know you're working at this job of this goal that you're passionate about, and then you see the other things that are kind of, you know, falling to the wayside, which is unfortunate. You know, like there's things that you're sacrificing at home to make this business work, which anytime anyone has a business, I think that's going to happen. It doesn't True. Have to be a recording studio. It could be, you know, a shoe store,
sure.
or apothecary or restaurant, yeah. whatever it is.
Were you married at this time?
Yeah, I've been. I was married when we were still in college.
Mm-hmm.
So Shaney was 19, I was 22 when we got married. And, you know, I was, again, working for this guy, Mike Sack, over at Trackmaster. And I was doing assistant engineer type jobs. And at that time, I would still get paid to engineer sessions, but let's say my salary, if you want to call it that, to help me out was only $640 a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're there every day. You may not have a session, you know. So that's why the Channel 2 thing came in, which was good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, I tell some of my students, it's good to know as much as you can, because that only makes you more valuable or opens
more marketable.
Right.
Yeah.
More doors open.
Don't you think, like, I feel like, I don't know if it's always been this way or if it's a recent-ish trend, but I feel like there's a problem with that. I like the idea of doing one thing and doing it well instead of having to always just figure something out new just to get by. Do you know what I mean? Like the sense of being an expert at something, you know, like if you could just be a recording engineer during all those times and during mm-hmm. now, because I know you do other things too, but do you think if you could just do that one thing, it would be a benefit to you?
Yes and no, I guess. Yes, yeah, so it would be nice if that was the way it was. And if I wanted to, you know, go back into it full-time like I was, and sometimes I am working full-time at it. It all depends what yeah. happens from month to month or what projects are happening. But I think I would put more limitations on it, where I would try to make it less of that 12 to 12.
Right.
You know, it would be more like a set schedule. Like I know there's other engineers in town here that they do an 8-hour shift and that's it. They don't do those marathons
mm-hmm.
Sessions. The thing about it is, though, that I guess that can be worrisome or problematic, is that this isn't not everyone needs to record something today. You know, so you have those ups and downs
yeah.
of like, hey, we had a busy month, there was a session every single day, or multiple sessions every day. And then next month, is the phone on? Like, yeah. You keep picking it up. It's like, oh.
Still working.
I have a dial tone here. Thank God. I just wish someone would call me. You know?
I know, really. I think in so many creative type endeavors, that's part of it. It's why a lot of people don't do it, because of the risk, right?
Yeah.
And you actually have taken a lot of risks in your career. It really is true, right? Opening your own business was a risk. Did you go down to Disney or something for a while?
So, yeah, I mean, that was a whole thing where the studio was doing okay, but it wasn't doing great. And my wife and I just kind of had to, like, you know, get out of town and clear our heads and everything and just kind of, like, be together, because we got married so young. And, you know, like 3 months after we got married, Abigail was born, you know? So we didn't have really any time for us to be us married. I mean, obviously Abby's going to go down to Florida with us, you know?
Right.
But this opportunity came up to move down to Florida, Orlando, and work for Disney, which we did back in 2000.
What was the job?
So I was a stage technician down there. Primarily, I did more of the audio side of things.
For in the theme park, like in the park?
In the parks and part of the show. So most of the time I worked at, they had this half hour mini version of their Hunchback musical, you know, but it was kind of crazy. It was like this half hour show. It was a great, like, Broadway type show.
Yeah.
It was probably like one of the best shows that were down there.
Right. Half an hour, what, on the hour? How many shows a day?
So we did 5 shows a day.
Okay.
But again, it was pretty technical. A half-hour show. There were 4 actors that had mics. They all had in-ear mixes of what was going on. And there was 150 sound cues that I did within that half-hour show.
What's a sound cue?
So a sound cue would be, you know, this actor's on stage, you turn their mic on from to say the line. Then you turn it off and the line's over with. And the next person comes on the screen.
Oh.
So the audio lead had a setup where every show, whoever was the audio person, would do the show the exact same way.
Mm-hmm.
And he always wanted the mics turned off when they weren't speaking, the mics turned on when they were speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there were mixing cues for the music, like bring the swell up when they hit this one note or whatever, and it's got to come up, you know, whatever he wanted, from 0 dB to +5 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to bring it down to 0, bring it down to -5 at this point, and then you have to hit the sound effect for when they're trying to break into the church or whatever. So that show was cool.
Was that fun, or was that exciting, or was that nerve-wracking, or was that, did you like doing that?
I did like doing that, yeah. I do like working in theater when I can. I don't have a lot of experience in that, but
mm-hmm.
I do like working in live,
okay,
live theater, live shows. Was it stressful? Yeah. I mean, you have, I don't know, 2,000 people sitting there for this show.
Wow.
And you have to mix it. So it's like the microphones, let's say the microphone,
a battery
work,
or something, like,
right.
You know?
I mean, batteries weren't that big of a deal, because I'm always religious about changing batteries, and we would change batteries in the morning, turn the mics off, and then after lunch we would replace them. It's like, why lose a microphone for 25 cents?
Right.
You know, it's like, it's 25 cents
sure.
worth having that actor out on stage without the mic on. But there was, you know, crazy things that happened. Down there in Orlando, you have huge storms that come in. So we would have to maybe cancel the show because, you know, it's raining sideways. It was an outdoor theater, you know? So,
yeah,
like, you would have to turn it off. Or if there was lightning going on, you can't have any of the explosions on stage or that kind of stuff. The stack electricity could possibly set off the pyrotechnics. You know,
jeez.
So you'd have to, like...
Really?
Yeah. But that was, I mean, it was a great cast. It was a great show. I also worked at Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah.
So that was like a big show at that point.
Really? Wait, there was a sound stage or recording it down there? Or was
it was exactly like the set in New York.
Okay.
And they would film, sometimes they would film, you know, Regis Philbin would come down and film his episodes there.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same
uh-huh.
equipment that they used in New York.
Okay.
In the exact same size. It was a little bigger because obviously the crowds down there.
Uh-huh. How long did you live down there?
Not long. We were there for about 2 years.
Did Regis get you fired?
Yeah, that's my final answer. And we liked it down there, but we still kind of just missed being up north. You know, mm-hmm. I think if Orlando would have been more like Tampa, I guess, where it's on the coast, mm-hmm. we might still be down there, but we kind of missed being close to water. Uh-huh. Obviously, we could have moved to the other coast, though, but we decided to come back up north because uh-huh. at that time is when I, heard that Robbie Takic was opening up Chameleon West Recording Studios. And I've known him since I was, 14, 15 years old. And I reached out to him to see if he had any engineers on staff yet or what he was looking to do. And then we obviously Shaney and I talked about it. We decided to move back north.
Mm-hmm. You're also a musician, and so that's a whole other hat that you wear, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I want to just talk about, like, we just said earlier today, like, we're kind of similar because we both have, like, this really, I would say, a punk/sloppy sort of background. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so... Yeah.
Close enough.
Close enough. And so what were your... Were you ever at odds? Like, so you're working at Disney, and, like, in your heart of hearts, you're, like, this punk rocker guy. Did you ever resent any of that kind of corporate type of work?
I didn't, because I was still part of, let's say, the creative department, mm-hmm. so or the entertainment department. So we had a little, I guess, leeway compared to the other workers at obviously, like, I couldn't have an earring in or anything like that. My hair had to be a certain length. But, you know, I still would kind of, like, push the boundaries where I would color my hair when I was down there. I remember once I went down there and I had my hair colored, like, that red.
Cherry red.
Yeah, cherry red. So I still had that, and people could see it, but I just had to wear, like, a baseball hat or whatever. But there are ways to...
To still be yourself within that...
Yeah.
Under that umbrella.
Right, and I had to wear black all day, which is basically
perfect.
What I wear anyways.
Yeah.
You know?
So, punk bands, you were part of a kind of cool scene in Buffalo, would you say the 90s? Like,
yeah, it's probably 90s.
There was a lot of cool stuff happening here, yeah?
Yeah.
And more people were at shows. This is just my opinion, but, like, first of all, there were less options for people to do on weekends or whatever. Second of all, the style of music that you did, that I did, was popular at that time, right? Mm-hmm. And that must have been also fun and exciting times too, right?
Oh, yeah. The bands that I played with most of the time back then was Bobo. And we would play with...
Quintessential... punk rock band.
But we would always do shows with, like, Girl Pope or We Set 73.
Yeah.
We would normally play, like, Mohawk Place, which is still around. But it was what I thought was interesting back then, and I'm also glad we're away from it too, is that they would always have, like, those cover bands or, like, blues bands would play Mohawk Place on Friday. So Willie and the Reinhardts would play every Friday from, like, 7 to 10 or something. And then they would bring in the original music bands to play starting at midnight or, mm-hmm. or 11 till 4. Which, for some reason at the time, you're like, wow, this is really romantic and exciting.
You're like, we got a great spot. We're at 12:30,
that's,
you know?
Right. Yeah, or you would go home and, you know, set the alarm for 2:30 in the morning so you could be there by 3:30. It's, you know, kind of crazy when you think about it. And now everything has kind of shifted, you know? So Mohawk Place now, it's like they have late shows, but they're not really that late where they'll start at 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And they might go past midnight till 2 or something like that, but... Now it seems like they've moved it up. When I was living in Boston, they didn't have shows that were late in Boston in the 90s. It was like 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. you know, and you would get there, and which is what I thought was interesting is like, hey, what time do you go on? Well, doors are at 7:30, and you guys are going to play at 8. And you would go into the club, like TT the Bears or whatever club you happen to be playing in Boston, and on the side of the stage had a list. Of these are the bands that are playing. This is the time you go on. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, you have us playing at 8. I think we're going to wait till 8:15. And then the sound guy or the stage manager would say, hey, that's no problem. You're still off by 8:45. Mm-hmm. It's not like things would move around, you know? And then you would come back here, and it was kind of like the Wild West. It's like, the show's running late. It's like, how is the show running late? Like, you're the first band on the stage. Like, how is it running late? You know, just kind of like, oh, doors are at 9, and music is going to happen at some point, you know, and in some order. But it seems like more of those other larger cities, they had to schedule. Mm-hmm. Like, this is when it happens.
Yeah. It's so true. Do you still enjoy playing punk-ish music?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love it. I mean, it's as much as I love working in the studio, in a way, like working in the studio is kind of like a release for normal everyday life things. You know, playing music is another way to kind of get back, you know, to being at peace or just getting a way to relax.
Now, your son is in a very popular band right now. Mom Said No.
Right.
And so you go there to see him. And what do you notice? Is it the same as it used to be, or are there changes?
I think there are changes because it seems like it's harder to get people out to shows. But I think there's so many more places to play, and there's so many options that are happening now that maybe it's not that there's less people going out. There's just more people going out to different places.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so it's like in the 90s, there was, you know, you could play at Nietzsche's, you could play at the Continental, you could play at Mohawk Place.
And if you were really lucky, the Trelf.
A couple other places, you know? Right, or the Trelf. And now it's like, well, you can play, you know, Nietzsche's still, or you could play Mohawk Place, or this art gallery now has bands, or you have this other place
the local
that has
bars,
bands,
oh,
or
yeah.
You can play in this record store, which has beer and whatnot for sale, or you could still play the Trelf, or you can play this empty room and put your own PA in it, or you can,
yeah,
you know, it just seems like there's a lot more places.
Yeah, the distribution is just so much broader, right?
Yeah.
Not to mention, like, all the different sources you can get entertainment from. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, internet. Like, I think movie theaters have the same challenge, right?
Yeah.
They're similar things, you know?
Totally. I mean, well, you know, that's a good point. Like, you bring that up, Academy Awards are coming in, and it's like, you look at that, and it's no longer Warner Brothers Pictures is the forefront in movies. Now it's like, oh, you know, all the Academy Awards are going to Netflix or Hulu or whatever.
Yeah. I know you told me that a lot of times recording in the studio now, people will just come in with all the tracks done and they just want to sing or rap over everything done. They're not using physical instruments with their music. They bring in the music and you're just putting the vocals on. That's true, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's mostly with, let's say, like some of the hip hop projects I've done where they come in with a track that they've either downloaded from, you know, YouTube or SoundCloud or something like that, or they're working with a producer who actually produced that backing track for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be something that they liked that they didn't purchase, and then that track actually has like a watermark on it, which I don't understand, but I guess it's whole thing. So there's an audio watermark on it. So for example, you'd hear the beat going. Yeah, exactly. So like every 10 seconds here, beats.com,
like, really?
You know, underneath the track. I'm like, do you want that edited out? Or no, I like it. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, so again, there's like the old guy not understanding
that
whole thing.
So, but still the process is the same, right?
Yeah. But people too, I mean, with the equipment that has come down in price and ease of use, I guess, depending. There's a lot of projects where they'll come to me and I'll record their drums for them because they're not familiar with the studio space, and then I'll give them those files and they'll go home and then we'll add the guitars or the bass or whatever it is at home so they can, you know, save some money on the studio, and then they'll bring it back to get it mixed, or maybe they'll send the files out to get it mixed.
I don't know. What do you think? Do you think there's something to be said for recording a band live, and does that capture something that could not be captured if you do it like piecemeal like that?
Yeah. I think there's always a little bit of that chemistry that happens if you can get like those basic tracks of what you would see in a performance captured all at once. You definitely get that energy. And I still work with bands that do it that way, you know, where we'll go in the studio and it's like, all right, let's cut the, you know, let's see what we can keep you know, obviously knowing that we're probably going to redo the bass and the rhythm and everything mm-hmm. else
right.
after the fact. Really, we're just looking to get the drums at this point.
Right.
But when you can get that, you know, those basic tracks as a performance, I think that's usually something special that can happen. But just kind of going back on the one thing of talking about, like, people being able to buy the home recording equipment, like, obviously that has affected the studio business, you know?
Yeah, how much of an impact has that had?
I think it's changed that industry a lot because people now can do some of the recordings at home.
Not to mention a lot of people listen to music on their devices, on their phone. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm listening on my phone, some people used to say that if you don't record in the studio, the quality's not going to be as good.
And it's too generic. You know what I'm saying? So, for example, everyone can buy, you know, expensive microphones and bring them home, depending on what your budget is mm-hmm. for home or not, right? And the studios obviously have really nice microphones and inexpensive microphones. They have a whole selection. And, you know, you can have Logic at home, or you can have Pro Tools at home, or whatever digital audio program you want to use at home, but it doesn't mean you have an engineer at home. You know, it's like you can use it. It doesn't mean it's not going to be bad, and it doesn't mean that I don't know. It's kind of hard saying, because when you say people don't need to go to the studio, I feel like you do need to. But I also realize that there are some things that you can do at home to help your budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
If you go to a total opposite side of examples, I guess. It's mm-hmm. like I could buy a scalpel set, right? Like I could buy a scalpel, but it doesn't mean I'm going to do heart surgery at home. You know, it's like, well, I've got scalpels at home.
Yeah.
It's no problem. I can take care of it for you.
Uh-huh. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Right? It's like, I'll go to Mark's house. He's got some scalpels.
Your son is pursuing music just like you did. As a career, right? Did you ever have any reservations about that when he said he wanted to do that, or were you encouraging it? What are your thoughts about that?
We've always encouraged our kids to do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've just always wanted to make sure that if they started something that they finished it. So we didn't let them, let's say, sign up for some kind of lessons and then 5 weeks in or 10 weeks in, they're like, oh, this is kind of boring. I don't want to do it anymore. It's like, well, okay. You've got 30 weeks left of it, though, or whatever. So when he started to get involved in music, we encouraged it. You know, we didn't try to tell him not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We've always had that conversation like my parents had with me. It's like, that's great. You know, hopefully things will work out. But, like, what is your plan if it doesn't work out? You know, like, what is your plan B? Which sometimes can be good and bad,
right?
Because if you have a plan B, then you're not giving everything to your plan A,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And our daughter is kind of like not the opposite of him, because they're both very creative and they're both talented. You know, like she was a dancer; she really enjoys dancing, and now she does choreography for my wife's musicals at schools.
Mm-hmm.
But she, you know, her plan A is to become a counselor. You know,
mm-hmm.
but she still enjoys music. She likes going to concerts. She's, mm-hmm. You know, her fiance's in the band with Elliot. So I think we've always been a musical family. Like mm-hmm. You won't really go into our house and not hear music playing somewhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said a really good thing that Mike Zach gave you that one piece of advice. Mm-hmm. But what advice do you give young people who really want to pursue a career in music and whatever part of it is?
Well, I always tell them. And again, this is coming from, you know, another guy who I've worked with a lot and have known for years, Robbie Konikoff, who's the studio manager here at Black Rock. Obviously, he was the studio manager for Audio Magic back in the 80s, and he was the artist rep for Moog. So he worked with Devo back in the, you know, 70s and 80s, and he's done a lot of stuff. But when I interned with him, when he was over at Select Sound, one of the things he told me was this business is about 10% technical and 90% social, which I think is 100% true. So meaning, you know, it doesn't matter necessarily what equipment you're using or how good or bad you are at using that equipment, or what you're, you know, like what you're really good at or what you're really bad at. Not, I don't want to say bad at, like what you could improve upon. Mm-hmm. If people don't want to be with you for 12 hours a day for whatever reason, you're not going to do any work, right? So it's like if you are a really talented producer and engineer, but you're a hard person to get along with, right, or whatever, you know, you're not someone you want to spend a long time with, you're not going to get that much work done, no matter how talented you are.
So you tell students, develop that, your social skills, right?
Yeah. I tell them that they need to obviously know the equipment, but
it doesn't stop there, right?
Right. Totally not. And it's almost like the Disney mentality, too, where it's like the customer comes first. So the customer is your artist. The customer is your person in front of that microphone or whatever you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you like that kind of music or if you don't like that kind of music or whatever. It's, you know, you're there to give them the best recording experience that they could ask for.
Yeah, so sort of putting your ego, I guess, in the back seat, right? Because right, there's plenty of egos to go around in right, the industry, right?
Oh, of course. Good and bad.
Yeah, it's a good thing and a bad thing.
You can have a good ego and you can have a bad ego.
Right.
But it's one of those things where, you know, you're a recording engineer, so what's your job? Your job is to get clean signals recorded with the microphone. And it doesn't matter if that's someone singing, you know, to a karaoke track because they're trying to celebrate an anniversary, or if you're trying to clean up audio for a forensic case, or if David Bowie is singing the last song he's ever going to sing, or whatever. It's like your job is to work with the microphones and the sound that's happening in front of that microphone.
Do you think there's room for people to still go into this field?
I think there is, but you make your way. You have to create your own scene, whatever that is, and whatever that means to you, you know? So it's like, you can't just be narrow-minded, I guess, in the beginning. And it's almost like as you work and you get those projects, and normally when you start out, you're going to get smaller projects, just so the studio owners and managers know that you can handle yourself, that you can be a cool person to hang with as you work on this kind of stuff. You'll get like the 1 hour, 2 hour sessions, and those clients will multiply. And as you start doing more projects, I think you will, you know, your scene or your niche kind of like carves itself out, you know, like if you want to do more, like you can't just go, I'm only going to work with jazz bands.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's like, okay, well, you may not be doing too much work then, depending on what's happening. However, you work with this one person, maybe they're doing, like I said, maybe it's a karaoke track thing, or maybe it's, you know, they're recording some poetry. It doesn't really matter. And they happen to be friends with some musicians who are in another group, could be jazz, country, blues, whatever it is, then maybe that leads to another project, and then that leads to another project.
Right.
And after a while, those projects will, I think, start to show you where your path is going to be, if that makes some sense to you.
Yeah, that does. I like that. I really like that.
Hi, my name is Miranda Tsivinis, and I'm here with Lucas Rinaldi. We are both senior music industry students at SUNY Fredonia. Today, for the Great Unsung podcast, we are going to be giving a brief biography on Lillian McMurray, one of the most influential blues producers in the mid-20th century. Despite not having enough money for a radio in her childhood home, McMurray would go on to impact the world of blues and R&B, two genres she had little to no exposure to until she and her husband bought a hardware store in 1949. Their plan was to own and operate a furniture store, just like the one they had met in. After clearing out what was left behind in the property they had bought, the McMurrays had found a sack of brand new 78 records. The hardware store they bought used to sell music and had left behind the unsold vinyl. After looking through them, they picked out the Wynonie Harris's recording of All She Wants to Do Is Rock and put it on. McMurray was instantly hooked. She had never heard anything like it and praised it for its rhythm and freedom. Very quickly, she decided that the store they just bought would sell records, just like the ones she had just heard at their furniture store. One of the workers helping the couple out guided McMurray to a wholesaler, the only place she could buy these records in bulk. Almost as quickly as McMurray put the records up for sale, they were being bought. This might be due to the three-hour radio show she advertised through every day. McMurray quickly expanded to mail order records for rural areas without record shops and added listening booths to listen to new releases. This success attracted vocal groups to the store, which helped lead McMurray to the idea of recording new artists herself.
At just 28 years old in 1949, without having any knowledge of owning a business in the music industry, Lillian McMurray opened up her own record label, Trumpet Records, where she recorded many blues artists who created numerous classics. Some of the artists she signed included Sonny Boy Williamson, William Love, Big Joe Williams, and much more, which enabled her to establish the fifth largest indie label in the United States. Sam Phillips and McMurray became business partners, as she would often send artists to his studio to record. However, in the summer of 1953, Lillian had an idea of turning her furniture and record store into a studio, later known as the Diamond Recording Studio. McMurray had high standards when it came to choosing artists. She would always give her brutally honest opinion on the artists' vocals, their music, and even their attitudes. She wanted to critique the musicians she recorded in order to encourage them to work to the best of their ability. As R&B started rising in popularity, Trumpet Records planned on shutting its doors in 1955. Despite the closing of McMurray's first successful label, she went on to open another recording studio, known as Globe Records, that same year, which only remained in business until 1956. In the spring of 1999, at just 77 years old, Lillian Shedd McMurray unfortunately died of a heart attack in her hometown of Jackson, Mississippi. McMurray was inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame shortly before her death, which was an honor considering not many music producers had been added into the Hall of Fame, let alone any female record producers. Later on, in 2007, Lillian and Willard McMurray were honored with a historical marker where Trumpet Records once was in Jackson, Mississippi. Her love for music and her legacy will live on forever as one of the earliest blues influencers and producers in the South.
I think we're almost ready to wrap it up, but I have one more question for you, and it's this. Why is music important?
To me or in general?
Both or either.
Well, I mean, the studies have shown. I mean, if you look at that, there's the music is important or any kind of, or, you know, being part of theater. That's been proven that that helps people learn, you know, that helps people grow. It's just as important as the sports department. For me, it's just important because it helps you get through the good times and the bad times of life. You know, you can always think of a song where you think, wow, this is a great moment in my life. It was all because of music. Or you're associating that song with something mm-hmm. that happened.
What about making music? Same thing?
I think it just helps you grow. You know, I think as you learn new songs, like you and I talked about this earlier, you know, you get, hey, play this song that you're totally not the style of player for this. That helps you challenge yourself, get out of the comfort zone, and actually prove yourself that you can do it.
Yeah.
You know? It's almost like it shows you that you were selling yourself short when you really could do that stuff if you wanted to.
Sure.
You know, that you are capable of playing those parts.
Yeah, I like that. All right, Mark, thank you for your time. I appreciate you, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll put some detailed notes in this show, and we'll share it, and we'll get people to contact you when they want to come in and do some recording.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, talk to you soon. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Miranda Tubinus and Lucas Rinaldi are two of my SUNY Fredonia music industry students, and they did a fantastic job producing this episode and telling us a little bit about the amazing life of Lillian Shedd McMurray. And I want to thank Mark Warner Hunt, my friend, my bass player, and a talented, patient, and creative recording engineer. It's no surprise that he's one of the most sought-after and popular recording engineers in the Buffalo area. So, until next time, this is Allison Pipitone, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Great Unsung.